Our guest tonight, who has been here once before, is Brian Greene, an eminent young physicist and physical theorist, who is the author, was the author a few years ago of the book The Elegant Universe, which got a lot of high critical acclaim, and indeed was turned into a television series, and now the new book, The Fabric of the Cosmos, Space, Time, and the Texture of Reality. Well, I've been around for rather a long time, and I've been wondering, ultimately, what is real? You're here to tell me.
It's a tough question, and what physics has done over the last 100 years, it has shown that the intuitive notion of what's real, which is what you see, what you can feel, what you can touch, what you can think about, all of that is probably just an approximation to a much deeper reality that physics is now starting to reveal.
The image that comes instantly to mind is Dr. Johnson walking on the Strand with Boswell. And Boswell has been telling him about the Bishop Berkeley and his subjective idealism, which argues that there's no way of knowing that anything that you think exists, exists. In fact, you can't even be sure that you yourself exist. And hearing that nonsense, Johnson, as you remember, walks along to a large boulder, kicks it, and says, "Thus do I refute Bishop Berkeley." Was that a good refutation?
It was a refutation of a particular sort, so I absolutely agree that at some point you have to say, we got to begin somewhere, and certainly it's good to begin with what you can feel and what you can see. And that is what
you can stub your toe on.
What you can stub your toe on, exactly. And that's what Newton basically started to do in the late 1600s. He wrote down equations that describe the stuff that you can see, balls going through the air, the earth going around the sun, and so forth. But what we have learned since the time of Newton is that those laws are only relevant when things are big. And when things are very small, a whole new set of laws come into play. It's called quantum mechanics. And the reality of the quantum laws are actually very shocking, so different from what you'd think based upon experience.
But we also learned even before that that Newton was wrong when it came to things that are really, really big.
Yes.
That is to say, the universe out there.
Yes.
And that's Einstein's.
That's Einstein. That's exactly right. So in the early part of the 20th century, Einstein recognized that when things are very, very massive or when they're moving very quickly, a new set of laws again comes into play. Not Newton's laws, but the laws of relativity. And those laws are absolutely shocking. They teach us, for instance, that if you and I are moving relative to each other, time will elapse for us at different rates.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very strange idea. We ordinarily think that time is universal. It elapses the same way for you, for me, if you're on Mars, whatever, independent of circumstance or environment. We intuitively think that time just elapses uniformly, but it doesn't, and Einstein showed this.
And that generated some wonderful science fiction plots.
Yeah, absolutely has.
About space travelers,
sure,
who come back and the girlfriend is now 80 years old and you're still only 32.
Yes, but the thing is, even though it's only been realized in science fiction plots, that's part of science. That's not fiction.
Yeah.
We believe, according to relativity, that you could leap into the future if you so chose.
Do we have any kind of experimental data that bears upon that?
Oh, absolutely. So we can't make people go very fast. Near the speed of light is the speed you need to attain.
Well, we can make particles.
We can make particles. That's exactly right. So there are these accelerators, atom smashers around the world, where we can take a particle that ordinarily disintegrates in a tiny fraction of a second if it's sitting still on your tabletop. You put it in the atom smasher, the accelerator, you make it go very fast. It lives 10 times or 100 times longer than it did if it were just sitting on your table. That's as if you didn't live, say, 80 years, but lived 800 years or 8,000 years. And this has not been done for people, but it has been done for particles.
Then Methuselah may have been in on the whole deal a long time ago.
It could well be.
Maybe that's the explanation.
It could be an explanation, absolutely.
About the theory of the ultimately small, that is, about quantum mechanics, Richard Feynman, and you're rather fond of him, are you not? Says, "I think it is safe to say that no one understands quantum mechanics. Do not keep saying to yourself, if you could possibly avoid it, but how can it be like that? Because you will go down the drain into a blind alley from which nobody has yet escaped. Nobody knows how it can be like that."
Right, right. There's a
but
lot.
How did we find out that it was like that?
Well, through experiments. So I think what Feynman really meant in that phrasing is that if you try to take in quantum mechanics intuitively, you're going to run into trouble. Because everything that quantum mechanics says really runs counter to what our intuition seems to be telling us. But we do understand quantum mechanics mathematically. We can use it to make predictions, and those predictions are borne out by experiments. In fact, you know, a colleague of mine did calculations with quantum theory over the past 20 years. He came to an answer regarding properties of electrons, their magnetic properties. And the answer he got from calculation agrees with the measured number to 10 decimal places. So the match between theoretical calculation and experimental measurements is what gives us faith that these ideas, however strange they are describing the world.
When I was a sophomore at Brooklyn College, took Philosophy 101, the brilliant teacher, sitting behind a desk to illustrate that things are not what they seem, hit his desk, as I'm hitting this table right now, and said, "This seems to you to be solid, but in fact, it's blooming, buzzing electrons rushing around. There's nothing really solid there, but we apprehend it that way because we only have very crude sensation."
That's right.
He was right as far as
absolutely
went.
Right. Tables and every solid object that you see in the world around you is actually mostly empty space. And the empty space is punctuated here and there by atoms and molecules, which themselves have a nucleus, a lot of empty space, and then electrons that orbit around the nucleus. So it's very different from what you think.
But at the time, he made that very common illustrative comment in that class, just down the hall or in the other building in the physics department. They would have explained to you that, well, we know that the things are smaller, are very, very small, and we think we've got the final ultimate particles. Now, this was so far ago that I think it was probably before what were the ultimate particles before you guys got dissatisfied?
Well, it was basically protons and neutrons in the nucleus and then quarks inside of those.
Quarks.
We've gone further, but yes, that was the...
But you have gone further. The man who named the quark was...
Murray Gell-Mann.
Was Murray Gell-Mann.
Yeah, he was reading Joyce and Finnegan's
borrowing,
Wake.
Borrowing it from Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah.
Something quarks from Mr.
Three
Mark.
Three quarks from Mr. Mark.
From Mr. Mark.
Yeah.
We had Gell-Mann on this program probably about 10 years ago. We talked about his whimsy in naming it that way. But why didn't we stop with quarks?
Well, the problem with the conventional theory that does stop with quarks and electrons is that it is unable to combine that description with the description of gravity that Einstein gave us in 1915. So Einstein gave us the general theory of relativity, and it describes stars and galaxies fantastically well. And quantum theory, modeling the world as made up of quarks and electrons, describes the microworld incredibly well. But the problem is, those two theories conflict with each other. They are antagonists. And string theory, the theory that I work on, is the first theory to come along and show how you can put them together. That's why we had to go further.
But you say that quantum mechanics and relativity conflict with each other, meaning they generate opposite predictions?
Well, when you try to put the equations together from the two theories, they give nonsensical results. So, for instance, when you combine them and ask the combined equations to predict a number, typically the number they predict is infinity, which is a nonsensical prediction because you never measure infinity. Dials don't go to infinity. So you need to have a theory that doesn't run up against this problem.
The first time I ever heard the term, the theory of everything, was from a guy who was a pretty good friend of mine and was a frequent guest on this program, David Schramm, at the University of Chicago, who unfortunately died in an aviation accident as he was piloting his own plane. And David was very excited about that, and I think that's probably the first time I heard your name as well.
Yeah, well, you know, the theory of everything is a phrase that's been around, I guess, since the mid-1980s.
Who coined it?
I don't exactly know, and to tell you the truth, it's not one of my favorite phrases, because it kind of makes it sound as though, if you take it literally, that the theory is going to tell you literally everything, like what you had for breakfast.
But you will have gone as far as you can go. There'll be no questions left.
There'll be no questions left. And it also makes it sound like if you're not working on this particular theory, if you're working on, I don't know, chemistry or biology, what does that mean? You're working on nothing? Or if you're working on other aspects of physics, are you working on nothing? No. So what is better is to recognize that when one says the theory of everything, what one really means is everything in a very limited sense, which means the basic constituents of matter and radiation, and the basic forces that act on that microscopic
scale. It's the theory of ultimate irreducibility.
Yes, that's right. It's trying to get to the irreducible elements, so it's reductionism taken to its limit.
Irreducible elements and the irreducible action of those elements.
That's right.
Well,
so the forces is the word that we use for the action, but yes.
How do you ever know that you've reached final irreducibility?
It's a very tough question. You don't.
When Gell-Mann posited the quark, he thought that was the irreducible finality.
That's right. And, you know, it might still be. So string theory is not a proven theory. It's a theory which accomplishes many theoretical things, but we've yet to test it experimentally. But one way that you know that you haven't reached the end of the line is if the equations and the theory that you have is internally inconsistent, if it doesn't work, if it gives predictions that you can't make sense of. And that is the state of affairs if you leave string theory out of the picture. So it's pretty clear that without string theory, we've certainly not reached the end of the line with the conventional ideas. That doesn't prove string theory is right, but it does show that we need to go further.
Okay, so let's come to the final irreducible itsy-bitsy unit. What is it?
Well, if you take the path that I and many others around the world work on, string theory, the suggestion is this. Inside an electron, you can picture it as a little filament of energy, a little filament of vibrating energy. It kind of looks string-like. That's why we use this name string theory. And the wonderful idea is that just like the string in a violin can vibrate in different ways that your ears can sense as different musical notes, these little strings in string theory also can vibrate in different patterns. Now, they don't produce different musical notes. They produce the different particles. So a string vibrating in one pattern would be, say, an electron. A string vibrating in a different pattern would be a quark. So all of the particles arise from one entity, but the entity can vibrate in different ways.
But the single string would not generate a total quark.
No. Yes, one quark would be one string, if that's what you mean. Yes, and one electron would be one string.
So just taking the quark or the electron and defining it as something other than what we thought it was.
Precisely. It's made up of something that moves as opposed to being some indivisible ball.
Ah, it moves. Why does it move?
Well, it's a good question. Why do the strings vibrate at all? Yeah. One of the reasons is quantum mechanics ensures that you can't actually have any object in a location without moving. That's impossible according to quantum uncertainty. There's always going to be a certain amount of jittery, vibrating motion for any object. But perhaps the grander question is, why are there strings and why do they have the energy that allows them to move beyond quantum uncertainty?
By the way, are they in some meaningful sense material, ultimately microscopic, super microscopic objects, or are they rather energy?
Well,
or does the question fade out of reality when you reach that level?
That's my answer. I would say that at this level of resolution, the distinction between matter and energy kind of evaporates.
It's a difference that is not a difference.
Yeah, it's like Einstein's E equals mc squared, to use one equation. E is energy and m is mass. And that tells us that energy and mass are really convertible. You can go from one to the other. And when you're talking about the finest constituents, energy and mass are pretty much the same.
Well, if all of this turns out to be true, or has it already turned out to be true? Do we have significant empirical verification?
We have none. We have no empirical verification, and that's the big
gaping
hole. None at all. And I say that without
reservation. It just works mathematically.
It works mathematically. It puts together general relativity and quantum mechanics. Mm-hmm. It also solves some other problems that perhaps we can get into. But in terms of the theory making a prediction that someone has tested and confirmed, has not happened. We hope it will happen within, say, a decade. That would be great.
Well, has the theory made some predictions which, though not yet tested, are conceivably capable of test?
It's made some potential predictions, and I qualify it because it's not as though the theory comes down squarely and says things have to be a particular way because we don't understand the math well enough to do that. But being optimistic about the things that we don't yet understand, the theory has made predictions for what one may see at the Large Hadron Collider. This is a big atom smasher being built in Geneva, Switzerland. By 2007, 2008, it should be online. And it's very possible that if we're lucky, that machine may be able to probe the physics of string theory. We hope that that will happen.
Does string theory also generate predictions at the opposite level, at the ultimate macro level?
Not yet. So it does tell us things about black holes, but not things that we can literally measure today. It also tells us such things about how space can evolve in ways that Einstein wouldn't have thought possible. This is one thing that I've been involved with. It tells us that space can rip and tear and reconnect, changing its shape in a very exotic manner. But no, there is no incontrovertible prediction that the theory absolutely comes up with, such that if it wasn't confirmed, it would rule the theory out. So at the moment, if you ask me, can you prove string theory wrong? At the moment, I'd have to say we can't do it yet, but that's what we hope to be able to do one way or another, say, in the next decade.
It was you with the two colleagues, Aspinwall and Morrison, I believe.
Yes.
Who demonstrated, mathematically, I guess, that space can be torn.
That's right, exactly
and
right.
And that following upon such a tear come all kinds of interesting further rearrangements.
Yes, that's right.
We might talk about that after we pause for these words. Our guest tonight, Brian Greene, is professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia University. He is also the co-director there of the Columbia Institute for Strings, Cosmology, and Astroparticle Physics. That's a Fine mouthful.
Yes, it is.
And we're going to turn shortly to cosmology. Well, I guess we're turning to cosmology now when it comes to ripping or tearing time.
Yes.
Ripping or tearing space.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, the basic idea is that Einstein, in around 1916, when he finished general relativity, mm-hmm. recognized that it told us that space is not static. Space can stretch, or it can contract, it can twist, and so forth. But one thing that space can't do, according to Einstein's general relativity, is to rip. Now, we re-examine this question in the context of string theory, which goes beyond Einstein's general relativity by including quantum mechanics. And in this more robust theoretical framework, we found that space can rip. I mean, just like a piece of material, you stretch it enough, it'll tear.
Well, what does that mean for space to rip? You used to actually start your book with some interesting conjectures on whether space is really there at all.
Yes.
Or whether it's merely an idea we cooked up to fill the interstices between the objects that we know about.
Yes, and I think that space is a real thing. And part
it would be there if there weren't any bodies floating around in it.
Yes, this is a long-standing debate. You know, if you removed all of matter and all mm-hmm. of radiation from space, would space still exist as an empty vessel, an empty entity?
It's a great question.
Or would it simply have no notion of existing without the stuff that's in it? I think that it would exist, and that's pretty clear from Einstein's general relativity that it would, too.
Well, before we come to torn space, what would space empty of all radiation and of all whirling bodies, what would it be then?
Well, it would be kind of what you imagine in your mind, so sort of some empty arena. But people like Leibniz said, well, if it's empty and there's nothing in it, then I say that it doesn't even exist.
Yeah.
He would say sort of like, you know, if you have the alphabet, you got 26 letters in the alphabet, you start removing A, B, C, you remove all the letters. Does the alphabet still exist? Well, kind of not really. There's no such thing as an empty alphabet. But I don't think that argument applies to space. I think there is such a thing as empty
this
space.
This was actually an argument between Leibniz and Newton.
Yes, they went back and forth on this quite a lot because Newton said that space exists. He said that time exists. But Leibniz says, what do you mean? Where is space? I can't see it. I can't affect it. I can't smell it or clutch it. So why are you introducing a concept that's so far beyond our ability to interact with?
But when there's nothing in space, of what does space consist?
Well, that's a tough question. I can't answer it. I wish I could. In fact, if you ask me what the next revolution in physics will be,
mm-hmm.
I believe the next revolution will involve an answer to that very question. I think the next revolution will be us pinpointing the elementary entities that make up space-time itself.
And it would be elementary entities.
I think so.
Possibly something.
Well,
like,
I think, you know,
something like strings.
Well, it could be strings, but you know, more generally, think of a glass of water.
Uh-huh.
You know that the water is made up of H2O molecules, but a single H2O molecule doesn't look like water, at least not the conventional picture of water. I think the same is true for space-time. I think that space and time have the familiar properties that we intuitively know about, but they themselves are made up of entities, sort of like H2O molecules. We're still trying to figure out what those entities are.
So you and your colleagues posited, and on a mathematical basis, projecting from string theory, found that it was quite possible that space would tear.
Yes.
If space tears, that means that whatever it's made of is sundered, so that in between the one part of one side of the tear, the other side of the tear, is truly nothing.
Truly nothing. Not empty space, but truly nothing. And the kind of tears that we would imagine. Imagine that you have a region of space that looks like a donut.
Mm-hmm.
The tears that we were able to show can happen would allow a donut to sort of rip open and reshape itself into a ball. Now, you can't turn a donut into a ball without ripping it. We found that that kind of tear could happen in space, and that kind of change could happen.
I could turn a donut into a ball simply by mashing it.
Yes, but that would require, again, that pieces of space come together and merge.
Right.
Something that, again, cannot happen according to Einstein's general relativity. So both merging and ripping are the processes that we found could happen in string theory, even though they couldn't happen according to Einstein.
And following upon the rip comes what?
Well, it's really just another kind of way that space can evolve. So if you ask Einstein, what can space do? He'd say, well, it can stretch, it can contract, and so forth. We now say that it can stretch, it can contract, but it can also rip and fundamentally change its shape. That is something that we didn't know was part of the repertoire of spatial evolution prior to string theory.
And do you posit as well that that has happened?
It could very well have happened, say, in the early universe, when things were very hot and tumultuous. Space could have gone through many such rips and tears. We think it unlikely that it happens like right now today, because corresponding to the tear, there would likely be changes in the physical environment. Not disastrous changes, but changes that we should be able to see. We don't see them, so we suspect the tears aren't happening right now. But when we weren't around and things were more tumultuous, they could
have. How does this connect to the model that we get in inflation theory?
Well, inflation is a theory that doesn't require string theory, doesn't require rips and tears.
Better explain what inflation is.
Yeah, so good. So Einstein, when he studied the equations of general relativity as applied to the entire universe, as we mentioned, found that space could be expanding. People since that era have recognized that the way it expanded yielded certain problems, such as why was the temperature in one region of space the same as in another region of space? Why was space so flat, something that we have observed through various indirect measurements? Alan Guth, in 1980 or so, came along with a solution to this, which doesn't really step outside of general relativity, but it posits that in a very early universe, for a split second, like 10 to the minus 30th of a second, the universe went through an incredible growth spurt that we call inflationary expansion. It perhaps grew by a factor of 10 to the 30 or 10 to the 50 or 10 to the 100 or more in a fraction of a second. And this huge growth spurt, it turns out, winds up resolving all of the puzzles that I mentioned a moment ago. And we call this inflationary cosmology.
That is the Big Bang.
Well, that's right. So
it's at the beginning of the Big Bang.
That's a key issue. See, oftentimes people say, well, we have a theory of how the universe began at the Big Bang. That's wrong. That's not right. You see, the Big Bang is a theory of how the universe evolved from a split second after whatever happened at the very beginning. And since the bang is what's supposed to happen at the beginning, the Big Bang actually leaves out the bang. It doesn't say why space started to expand in the first place. Inflationary cosmology fills in this gap because it shows us that in the very early universe, gravity, it turns out, could be repulsive. Gravity could exert an outward push in the exotic environment of the first fraction of a second. And we believe that that outward push is what caused space to rush away, to rush outwards. It was the bang, as you say.
It must be very tedious for you to then have somebody ask what I'm now going to ask. It's a cliche, but all the same, it comes to everybody's mind. And what happened before that?
Good. I don't know is the most honest answer, yeah. But let me name some possibilities. Mm-hmm. One possibility is there was no before. There was no before because it could be that time itself started with this bang. And therefore, the notion of before, which is a temporal notion, may not have made sense. And that's a hard idea, but let me give an analogy. So if I'm walking on the surface of the Earth, and I'm heading north, and I pass somebody, I say, which way to go further north? They point me. I pass somebody else, which way further north? They point me again. When I get to the North Pole, if I say to somebody there, how do I go further north? They say, well, that doesn't mean anything. This is where north begins. You can't go further north than the North Pole. Maybe similarly, I can imagine 100 years ago, a billion years ago, 14 billion years ago. But if I try to go further back in time than the Big Bang itself, there may not be any further back. That may be where time begins, just like north begins at the North Pole.
But now we come to something else that's been very prominent in conjecture. How much mathematical basis for this conjecture there is, I don't know. You will know and will tell us. Namely, the notion, and you will remember who are the major theorists who started all this up, I forget, but the notion that our universe is only one of a vast number, possibly an infinity? Is
sure,
that
the multiverse idea.
The multiverse?
Yeah.
And thus, ours was just a little bubble that popped in one day out of other universes.
Yes, Andre Linde from Stanford is one of the great proponents of this
Russian
idea.
Guy, isn't he?
Russian fella, yeah. A great, great physicist, as well as some others as well. But it naturally follows from what we were talking about, because if you imagine that the universe sprouted, say, 14 billion years ago, big expansion of space, it could be that that was not a unique event. It could be that at far-flung places in our universe, other bangs have happened, causing space to sprout out from those locations as well, yielding a vast network, if you will, of universes that are all kind of connected to each other in some grand cosmic bubble bath, where every universe itself is one little bubble, but in the grand cosmos, there may be many of these bubbles.
Now magnitude needs to be entered into the picture. Our universe is composed of how many galaxies?
Well, we can count on the order of 100 billion galaxies.
100 billion galaxies.
Each of those has about 100 billion stars.
Yeah.
So, man, there are
a lot of
stars out there.
That's a lot of stuff out there. And its total reach in terms of observational distance is what?
Well, you can roughly call it, say, 14 or 15 billion light years. Mm-hmm. A light year itself is about 6 trillion miles, so you're talking pretty far. But in this grand picture, that's just a little dot.
And that's only one universe of a possible...
Infinitely many possible, yes.
Infinity, is that conceivable?
Conceivably, yes. This could be a network that's been going on forever.
An infinity of universes.
Possibly.
But they are not capable of being in contact with one another, are they?
Probably not. And that's what makes this idea a little bit beyond scientific testability. If we are forever separate from these other bubble universes, then it's a little hard to argue that they're real. But they do naturally come out of the theory.
Well, what question was Linde answering with this formulation?
Well, he was really trying to understand perhaps the question, how did time begin? And one answer for that is, time, as we think of it, is just the time in our little bubble, but perhaps we really need to think of a more global notion of time that covers all of the universes.
Yeah.
And from that point of view, maybe all of these bubbles have been around forever. So it's a rather unique and unusual way of thinking about how the universe is constructed.
And to get you off the philosophical hot seat, what was there before the beginning?
Yeah, there was you can talk about a beginning in our bubble,
yeah,
but when you talk about the beginning in the grand thing, there may not have been one.
But it does leave you inevitably with the question of the ultimate regress to the beginning of beginnings.
That's right. But maybe in this particular case, it just goes on forever. That's one suggestion.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this whole multiverse idea I find very compelling and provocative. People have used it to try to address other questions. For instance, you could say, why is it that conditions are just right for life to exist in our universe? Certainly life does exist. We're here. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that if conditions in our universe were even a little bit different, if, say, the electron weighed a few percent more than it does, or if gravity was a little bit weaker, it turns out, it's not hard to see, we wouldn't exist.
And we refers to all organic life.
Yeah, life as we know it.
Yeah.
So some people say, well, perhaps the answer is, you've got all these bubble universes. In the other bubbles, conditions are different, and we don't exist in those universes. So the reason we exist in this particular bubble is it's the one in which we can exist. So it's not really a puzzle. We are here because we can exist here, and that's the end of the story. That's an approach
that
some
people... We're here because somebody had to be here to ask the question.
That's right. So if conditions were different, we wouldn't be around to ask, why are we not here?
Yeah.
And the fact that we can ask the question, why are we here, begs the issue because the conditions had to be right for us to be here in the first place.
Coming back to string theory, but also staying with cosmology, what does string theory do to alter our cosmological vision?
Well, it really enriches it tremendously, and this is the work that we're doing today. First off, string theory demands that we have more than three spatial dimensions.
Yeah. We come now to seven other dimensions.
Exactly. So, you know, we're
talking... What are their names, by the way?
We don't have real names for them. And sometimes people ask me, can I think of the dimension as love and hate? No, we're really talking about spatial dimensions, and real dimensions like the ones that we see in the world around us. So when we were talking about cosmology a moment ago and talking about expansion of space, we were talking about the expansion of the three spatial dimensions that we know about. In string theory, you have to work harder. Now you've got to talk about the other dimensions, too. For instance, why don't they expand and become big and obvious? We think that they're probably very small. You have to give an argument. You have to give a proof of
that. What does
it mean
for a dimension to be small?
Well, it means that if you were to walk in that direction, you would come back to your starting point very quickly. So think of a cylinder or an inner tube or a garden hose. If a little ant is on the garden hose and it walks around the circular part of the garden hose, it comes back to its starting point very quickly. So that dimension is very small. If it walks along the length of the garden hose, it can keep on going pretty far. That dimension is long. Similarly, the three dimensions that we know about, they're pretty big. You could go off into space pretty far, and you might never come back. But the extra dimensions we think are very tiny and curled up much like the circular part of the garden hose.
Somehow I have a feeling that the Mobius strip would be
Well, the Mobius strip is a tricky one. That's an example where...
The three dimensions reduced to two, in the way.
Well, it's actually two-dimensional, but it has the property that it sort of has no inside or outside.
Yeah.
Because you can start on one side and you can wind up on the other.
So it's two-dimensional becoming one-dimensional, I suppose.
Well, it's really that it's not orientable, is what we call it, which means that it doesn't have a well-defined notion of inside versus outside. We don't think our universe is like the Mobius strip. It could be, but there's no evidence for that.
Well, how do you come to the number 11 dimensions? Why those seven others rather than... six others or 20 others?
Yes, well, that really comes from the mathematics of the theory, so it's not pulled out of a hat. For the first time, really, in the history of physics, we have a theory where you don't put the number of dimensions in by hand. That's what Newton did. Newton looked around and said, three dimensions, put that in. Einstein did the same thing, three dimensions, but then he included time mm-hmm. for a total of four dimensions. String theory doesn't allow you to put in the number of dimensions by hand. It has an equation that tells you how many dimensions there are. And the strange thing is, when you solve the equation, the answer is not three space dimensions, it's more. That's shocking, but that's where the math leads us.
What do you do to visualize them? You've just visualized with an interesting metaphor the ant on the garden hose.
Yeah, I really
but
do.
But beyond that, how do you visualize
them? Well, to tell you the truth, I really use those kind of pictures all the time. Even when I'm doing mathematical calculations, which talk mm-hmm. about these extra dimensions rigorously, in my mind, I'm constantly thinking of things like the garden hose or other versions of the garden hose that allow me to illustrate other features of the dimensions.
Let's have a few other versions.
Well, the garden hose is a good one. Another good one is imagine you take a piece of paper.
Uh-huh.
A piece of paper begins nice and flat with two dimensions that are on equal footing. Now roll up that tube of paper into something that is cylindrical. You now see the process by which a dimension that was straight is turned into a dimension that's circular. This kind of process, we call it compactification. This kind of process may well occur in the universe. Dimensions can begin in one shape and then curl up and take on a different shape. That kind of image also is very helpful in certain circumstances.
But these dimensions are all ultimately small and essentially affect only the behavior or help us to map and track the action of strings.
Yes, but I would want to emphasize that even though they're so small, they potentially have a major impact on physics that we observe in the world around us. Because take a property of an electron like its mass. It's a very important property what an electron weighs, because as I said before, were it to weigh a different amount, the universe as we know it wouldn't actually be here. We believe in string theory that the mass of an electron is associated to the vibration of a string. Now the string can vibrate not just in the dimensions we can see with our eyes. The string is so small that it can also vibrate into the curled up dimensions. So the geometry, the twists and turns in the extra dimensions can affect the vibrational pattern of a string, much like the twists and turns in a French horn affect the vibrations of the air that's rushing through it. So the shape of the extra dimensions may affect how strings vibrate, so it may affect the things that we observe, like the mass of the electron or like the strength of gravity. So those features of the everyday world may actually rely upon the extra dimensions.
It was the dream of the alchemist to turn lead and other such inert metals into gold. They never quite succeeded, as far as we know. But if you had an ultimate engineering approach or an engineering science for the little strings, that could lead to the easy transformation of anything into anything else.
Oh, without a doubt. So even before string theory, frankly, we've known that materials can transmute into other material. You know, you have radioactive decay where one kind of atomic species turns into another kind of atomic species. And indeed, if string theory is right, all of these features are vibrations of strings. If you change how a string vibrates, you change the kind of particle that it is, which would be a kind of subatomic alchemy, absolutely.
Is that ultimately going to be an achievement?
I don't know. We're talking about objects, strings, if these ideas are correct, that are, say, a hundredth of a billionth the size of an atomic nucleus. That is
so
small.
Say that again. Let's get that scale clear.
A hundredth of a billionth of a billionth of an atomic nucleus, 10 to the minus 20. Of an atomic nucleus.
Yeah.
So, you know, just to give you an analogy, if you were to take an atom and enlarge it to be as big as the entire known universe, then one of these strings under the same scale of magnification would become as big as a tree. So a tree is to the universe as a string is to an atom. Mm-hmm. That is how tiny these objects
are. That's mighty small.
That's very small.
We'll never get there.
Well, I don't know that we'll get there directly.
We won't ever see them.
Well, here's the thing. There are many things in science that couldn't see directly at first, but we learned of their existence through indirect means. I mean, black holes are a good example. You can't literally see a black hole because it's black. It doesn't give off light. But we have been able to learn about the existence of black holes by observing indirect evidence, light that is emitted by gas that gets too near a black hole. So again, our hope is that through indirect means, we can see the imprint, the fingerprint, if you will, of string theory, even if we don't see the strings themselves.
We are due for another quick round of commercials. I should make clear that we are drawing from, but hardly covering the full content of a fine new book by Brian Greene, who is a great popularizer in the best sense. You do very serious scientific work, but you also have the gift to translate it for ordinary folks, particularly to translate without much or even without any mathematics.
Yes, I think that's the key thing, to use ordinary language, because many people are intimidated by math or haven't learned math.
But you are a mathematician, of course.
Yes.
The new book by Brian Greene is titled The Fabric of the Cosmos, Space, Time, and the Texture of Reality. It's published by Alfred A. Knopf and Company, and we'll return to this conversation directly after these words. And we return to Brian Greene, professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia University and co-director of that university's Institute for Strings, Cosmology, and Astroparticle Physics. The new book that we're drawing from is The Fabric of the Cosmos, Space, Time, and the Texture of Reality. Well, we've talked about space, we've talked about the texture of reality. We haven't talked much about time, but there's no problem about time. Time flows.
Well, you think so. Certainly based on experience, you would say that it flows from second to second to second.
From then to now to...
Yeah, but the problem is when you study the equations of physics and the ideas of physics, you don't find any evidence of a time that flows, no matter how intuitive that seems. And in fact, if you follow Einstein's relativity to his logical conclusion, I think, and many agree, that it really seems to indicate that the flow of time is illusory. It's something that we impose on the universe from our minds, but it's not real.
Well, now, you said the existence of space is not illusory. Space is really there.
Well, I say that space and time are both real, but the flow of time, I would say, is a property of time that we feel is intrinsic to time, but I don't think it is.
Well, from that it would follow that if I wanted to go backwards, I ought to be able to do so.
Not necessarily. It doesn't mean that you can navigate time with complete freedom and complete ease, but it is the statement that the familiar organization that we all impose on the world, past is gone, present is real, future is yet to appear, that organization is not actually fundamental or real.
So Shakespeare and Macbeth had it wrong. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creep in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time.
It would take me a little bit to parse all of that, but if what they were saying is that time flows, then I would indeed say they have it
tomorrow
wrong.
Tomorrow follows an earlier tomorrow, follows another tomorrow, to the last syllable of recorded time.
Well, I'm
it
not
does
saying,
suggest that the
yeah,
time has an end also.
Well, I'm not saying that time doesn't have an order to it. I'm not saying that past, present, and future don't actually exist and that future doesn't follow past, but I am saying that that demarcation is not fundamental. See, well, let me give an example of what I mean by that. According to Einstein, if you and I are both wearing identical wristwatches and we synchronize our watches and we move relative to each other, then our watches will fall out of synchronization. Even though they were initially set the same, when we return and compare our watches, their readings will be different. Now, if this is not controversial, okay, this is part of relativity. Now, what this means is if our watches don't agree, then we can't agree on what's happening right now because we don't agree on what now is since our clocks are different. Mm-hmm. We can't agree on what the past was. We can't agree on what the future is. You may call something future, I'll say, no, that's past. You may say something's present, I'll say, no, that's past. So the whole organization into past, present, and future is subjective. It's not part of how the universe is put together.
I've got a small instance which might be illuminated by that. It's common to what we're doing right now. It's common to radio talk shows. We are on the time delay. I am now speaking the words that I am speaking, but they are being heard 6 seconds later.
Yes, so I'll wait 6 seconds before people have a chance to hear them and digest them. No, but seriously, that's an important point in terms of the way in which, for instance, signals travel. Mm-hmm. So indeed, you know, even light travels at light speed, which is really fast, but there's always a delay. So I'm looking at you right now, but I'm seeing you as you were about 10 billionths of a second ago, because that's how long it takes the light to bounce off your face and enter my eyes.
Just as you look out into the universe and you see the most distant objects as they were 14 billion years ago.
Yeah, that's right. So when you look at stars, you're seeing them, say, 100 light years away.
They're no longer there, really.
That's right. So when you look out into space, you're actually looking back in time. All of this is very important, but it's not exactly the point that I'm making. The point I'm making is that time itself and the familiar way that we organize it into past, present, and future, and we think in our bodies, we think that the past sort of flows into the present, which flows into the future, that is completely subjective. Because we can't even agree on what the past, present, and future actually are.
Is the notion of flow and of continuity and the smooth progression from instant to instant to instant, is that in itself a human perceptual imposition?
It may be as well. That I don't know the answer to. We are seeking to determine whether time is really continuous or whether it kind of accrues in steps. a second jumps to the next second, or does it actually have a continuous structure? We don't know.
Well, what about
yet.
Substantiality? You said that space is finally composed of stuff.
Yes.
Even when we can't see any stuff there.
Yeah.
We can't say that time is composed of stuff.
I think we can. I think we can.
Really?
I can't say it with precision today, but if you ask me what's the next revolution in science, the next revolution, I think, will be figuring out what the entities that make up space
we're
going
to find time particles of some kind?
I think so. I think we're going to find atoms of space and atoms of time. I put those in quotes because I don't know what they actually are, but that's where we're headed. And I think once we understand the fundamental makeup of space and the fundamental makeup of time, that will be the leap. That will be the thing that takes us to the next breakthrough.
Are you then also considering the possibility, you must be, that time itself is composed somehow of strings?
Yes, it's possible. Just as space conceivably is stitched together by the strings of string theory. I don't know that. I don't even know that string theory is right. But it's possible that space is actually composed of strings that organize themselves in the right manner, and maybe that time itself is similar.
And if we learn more about time, I suppose, again, we can catch up with science fiction and begin to consider how you do, quote, time travel.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, there are two kinds of time travel. There's time travel to the future, and there's time travel to the past. Time travel to the future is not mysterious, according to the laws of physics. No, I don't just mean that you and I are both going from 1 second to the next. I mean that if I want to see what the Earth is like a million years from now, or 100 million years from now, Einstein laid out a strategy for accomplishing that. You build a spaceship, you head off into space at nearly light speed, you turn around and you come back. And if you went fast enough, then when you come back, a year might have elapsed according to you. But when you look out of your ship and you examine Earth, a million years or 100 million years will have gone by for everybody that stayed still on Earth itself. You will have jumped into Earth's future. This is part of relativity as we understand it. Now, look, building the ship is not something we can do, so we can't actually accomplish this today or perhaps ever. But from the point of view of fundamental physics, traveling to the future, jumping to the future, is something that we understand.
How fast must that ship go?
It's got to go very close to the speed of light. Yeah. So the speed of light is 186,000 miles per second. That is incredibly fast. That's fast enough to go around the Earth seven times in a single second. It's not something we can do, perhaps ever. I don't know. But I'm not talking about practicality. I'm talking about the laws of physics.
Mm-hmm. Of course, if Captain Jean-Luc Godard lets us onto the Starship Enterprise, we can go into space warp, whatever that is.
Yeah, that's a little tricky idea, space, well, you know, time warp and space warp and going at warp speed. I don't know that that is something that we can do, but, you know, in terms of the bending and warping of space, we do understand it. Can we ever control it and willfully do it? I don't know.
Did I not read sometime within the last few years of some physics experiment which supposedly demonstrated to an ultimate macro millisecond some kind of displacement of time?
I'm not exactly sure what you're referring to.
Not sure either. I thought there was some physical experiment which suggested that we have the beginning of time travel.
That doesn't ring a bell, but I should say that, again, like we're talking about with particle accelerators, when we said that you put that particle in the machine and you make it go around very fast and it'll live much longer than it would and then it was sitting on stationary on the ground, when that particle leaves the accelerator, it really has jumped into the future.
Yeah.
Its lifetime is only a fraction of a second, but it's lived to see 5 seconds.
Perhaps I'm just
by.
Remembering somebody interpreting some such data.
Possibly,
in
yeah,
that
absolutely.
Fashion.
Could well be.
Treating it then as an analog.
Yes, it's as if you have sent that particle into the future
when
you put it into an accelerator, absolutely.
But you think that the mechanics that will flow from deeper and fuller and more accurate knowledge of the physical reality may ultimately give us some sort of purchase on time travel itself?
Well, this time travel to the future, again, is non-controversial. What about to the past? Perhaps that's
harder,
issue. That's much harder because, as you can know from various science fiction films, there are paradoxes that crop up. You know, you travel to the past, you see a young man who turns out to be your young grandfather, who is so young that he's yet to give rise to, say, your father, and you have some unresolved issue with him, and you go over and you knock him off, you kill him, say, before he's been able to give rise to your father, and therefore you were never born. So the question is, how were you there to perform that act in the first place? So there are puzzles if you can travel to the past. That doesn't mean travel to the past is impossible, though I think it is impossible, but there are some puzzles you have to deal with.
When it comes to the playing with time, the great science fiction people have, of course, taken people to the past, taken them to the future. H.G. Wells in his Time Machine is one of the early but not the first. But another fascinating idea that has popped up now and again is alternate, or rather deviating, time tracks.
Yes.
So that as if, well, you could illustrate that better. How might we exist elsewhere, not now, but a minute from now?
Yes, well, there is an idea of parallel universes that naturally
exactly.
emerges, say,
yeah.
from quantum mechanics, which suggests that there isn't just one universe. There are many copies of this universe, for instance, that differ from our universe by small or big deviations, but nevertheless are there. So there's a copy of you in each one of these universes, and in this universe right now, you're talking to me. In the next universe, perhaps I got caught in traffic and I never showed up, and you're doing the show alone, and so forth. So all these possibilities are born out in these parallel universes. So it's as if time is not a single river, it's as if time has tributaries, and it branches, and the branches are these different universes where time carries on in that universe in a familiar manner, but overall, you've got these many, many copies of the universe.
Which Greek philosopher is it that gives us the metaphor of time as a river?
I don't know where that originates. I don't know at all.
Yeah. But it's an old Greek idea.
Yeah, I think it's been around for quite a long time. Because
time is a river, and you can't ever step in the same river twice because it keeps flowing forward.
But here's the thing I don't like about that metaphor, even though I use it. It suggests the flow. It suggests the flow
yeah.
of time, which I don't think is actually real. So rather than a river, I like to think about it as make the river really cold and everything gets frozen. So you've got all these frozen tributaries, and that's really my picture of this multiverse picture of time.
Now, speaking of time, it is almost time to stop for some... quick update on the evening's news, and to go to the telephones. We're opening the phone lines right now. Anything you want to ask, any news you want to provide about what the universe is really like and what reality really is, we're glad to hear from you. The number is, of course, 591-7200. 591-7200. We will probably go to the phones directly after the coming newscast. So if you want to call, move quickly, 591-7200. If you're listening to us over the Internet at some great distance, perhaps on Andromeda or thereabouts, you can reach us more easily by email. The email address, extension 720, as one word, at tribune.com. Extension 720 at tribune, T-R-I-B-U-N-E, .com, or 591-7200. Three people have come to my aid via email to remind me that the man who gave us that great metaphor of time being like a river, you can't step into the same river twice, was, of course, Heraclitus. Years ago at Second City here in Chicago, the great comic, one of the first Second City group, Severin Darden, did a famous monologue about Heraclitus coming home and saying to his wife, Helen Heraclitus, you know, time is like a river, and so on, and you can't step into the same river twice. And her answer is, Heraclitus, that's nonsense. Run downstream, and you'll be in the same river. And the famous line by Darden was, he was amazed. So thanks to all who have reminded me of Heraclitus. And we will go to the phones, I think. Time to put on the headset. Volume knob, I should have told you before, below the table on your left. 591-7200 is the number. And we will shortly go to a call as soon as I'm told what call that is to be. I don't quite know yet, but the information arrives, and here it is. And here is the first caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Oh, hello. I'm sorry. Your screener didn't warn me. I had three questions, and the first question was about empty space. Now, physicists know that empty space, there's still something there. There's still the vacuum energy. And is it possible that vacuum fluctuations... that empty space, that sort of this emptiness, doesn't like to exist, that these vacuum fluctuations start interacting and start actually creating something?
Well, the point that you're making is a good one, and it's the idea that in the last few decades, we've learned that the notion of nothingness, the notion of emptiness, is a very subtle one, because in quantum mechanics, due to the quantum uncertainty principle, it turns out that even in what we ordinarily think of as completely dark, completely empty space, there's always some quantum agitation. There's always some quantum jitter of the, say, the electromagnetic field or the gravitational field is jittering up and down. So even though empty space may look placid, if you examined it microscopically, there'd be a lot of quantum activity going on. And that activity can have energy. It can contribute to the energy of the universe, and there are implications of that.
And my second question, does string theory somehow predict a direction of time? I know you were talking about flow, but you really didn't mention direction.
Yes. It's a very good question. So one of the other basic features of time that we all experience is that time seems to have an arrow, a direction to it. There are events that always seem to unfold in one sequence and never the reverse. The prototypical example, if you take an egg, it can splatter on the floor, but we never see it unsplatter. You can take a glass, it can shatter on the ground, but it never unshatters.
So if we have a video or a regular film and reverse the order, we can see it.
You can see it happen, but it looks so bizarre
because
you never see that in the real world. So a question is, why is it that certain events, in fact, many events, all events, in fact, happen in one sequence of events, but never the reverse? Well, when you look at the laws of physics, it turns out that there's no explanation in the equations. The equations seem to treat future and past, forward and backward in time, on exactly equal footing. But experience shows that there's anything but equal footing between them. So how do you cure this mismatch between the theory and observation? It's a chain of reasoning that I won't go through in detail. I go through it in the book systematically, but let me just give you the final answer. The final answer, we believe, has to do with the Big Bang itself. We believe that the Big Bang started the universe off in a highly ordered state, and we have been living through the degradation of that order for the last 14 billion years. So in essence, when you see that egg splatter on the ground, the fact that it splatters and it doesn't unsplatter is telling you something deep about what conditions were like at the very beginning of the universe. And a fantastically interesting connection between everyday experience and the origin of the cosmos.
There are intimations here of the law of entropy.
Yes. Well, what I'm referring to when I say that the relentless drive towards greater disorder, the more technical term in physics would be entropy, the drive toward higher entropy. Exactly right.
An email, very simple. If one speeds up to travel into the future, why not slow down to travel to the past? Nothing in the universe is still. Isn't that right?
Well, I wish it was so easy. So, indeed, the faster you go, the slower time is for you, and therefore, compared to somebody else, you will travel into their future. But the slowest you can go is not moving at all, and then we're all just elapsing at the exact same rate. So, unfortunately, the slower you go, you don't go backwards.
So, back to the drawing board.
Yeah.
591-7200 is the number. You are the next caller. Good evening.
Good evening. I'd like to know if you could possibly discuss the similarities and differences between fractal geometry and string theory, if there are any.
Well, there aren't any real connections in a deep way. So fractal geometry was invented in the last couple of decades, and it indicates that there are useful ways of thinking about geometry where you don't have one dimension or two dimension, but you might have 1.5 dimensions or 2.3 dimensions. And these ideas have been very useful at describing, for instance, natural geographic structures like the coastline of a continent. It turns out when you examine it, it has the same structure regardless of the distance scales of which you examine it. You might look at it over the scales of miles or half miles or quarter miles. It seems to always have a repetitive structure of jigs and jags and so forth, which can be described using this fractal geometry. It doesn't really come in a particularly deep way into string theory, where we are really talking about the fundamental dimensions of space themselves, not an entity within space. I think that's really the main difference.
And we thank the caller. A moment out before we go back to the calls, to talk about you and people like you. You are you're a physicist, but you're not an experimenter. Have you ever done an experiment in your life?
I've never done an experiment in my life. I've always done theory. That's right.
You sit there and write equations on pads or you argue about them up at a blackboard.
Yes, exactly. And the calculations that we do, you know, are usually pencil and paper. Sometimes we use computers to help us out. But they're all theoretical, and the goal of every theorist is to do a calculation and come up with something that you can give to an experimenter who can then do an experiment and test it.
I know a bunch of guys who are busy at Fermilab here and have
Yes.
been associated with Fermi for many years, and they are, in a way, the troops carrying out the testing the predictions that people like you generate.
Ideally. The hope is that theory and experiment can go forward hand in hand. You know, the theorists come up with an idea, the experimenters test it, they may find something unexpected, and then the theorists have to sit down and try to explain what it is that the experimenters found. The unfortunate thing is that in the last decade or so, theory has gone so far ahead of the experimental technology, experimental capabilities, that many of the things that we study today theoretically are pretty tough to test. And as we discussed earlier, our hope is that will change shortly. But for the moment, it's tough to test the ideas that we're developing.
You know that I'm a psychologist, a mere social psychologist, in fact. But one of the great questions in psychology has always been, what patterns of character, for that matter, what types of organization of mind, of cognitive process, go with success in various kinds of occupations and professions? With that as a general query, what can you tell us about the really creative physical theorists?
Well, I think that the best theorists are the ones who can get really obsessed with a problem, obsessed with a question, and think about it to the exclusion of everything else in their lives. You know, Einstein would sometimes work for days, weeks, months, even years on a single problem. And that's very hard to sustain, that kind of concentrated, passionate drive on a single-minded goal. But in the hands of an Einstein, that obsessive character yielded some of the deepest insights that our species has ever achieved.
So the what should be on the family crest or the escutcheon of any really great physicist would be Jack Benny's famous line when the robber says, your money or your life. I'm thinking.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, even more than that, I think that the thing about a theorist is you have to be willing to live in a state of confusion. And that really characterizes the vast majority of our professional lives. Most of the time we're confused. Most of the time we're trying to find answers, but we're in the dark. And every so often you emerge into the light, and that's a great moment. But you have to relish being in the dark because you're there a lot.
Einstein was in the dark, though he revolutionized physics, was in the dark for the last 40 years of his life.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good example of an obsessive search that didn't work out for him.
What was he looking for?
Well, he was looking for this thing that he called the unified theory, which would be a single idea, a single equation, if you will, that might describe everything in the universe, the big, the small, and everything in between.
So he was after the theory of everything.
He was after what you could call the theory of everything, in the qualified sense that we discussed earlier. Yeah. And every so often he thought he'd had it. He thought he'd found it, that is. But when it was studied in detail, it was recognized that he didn't. In the end, he worked for 30 years, and he isolated himself from mainstream physics. Most physicists thought that he had sort of gone off the trail. He'd sort of gone down a path that wasn't worthwhile, wasn't useful, and he kind of became an outcast to an extent in the physics community. It's very sad. The greatest genius, in some sense, decoupled, moved away from the developments in science because he had this obsessive goal. Now, many years later, we learn that he was just ahead of his time. We now think that string theory is the unified theory that he was looking for, and now many, many, many people work on the unified theory. So it's not that he was wrong or misguided, he was just early.
Who gives us the first glimmer of string theory?
Well, it was found by accident, to tell you the truth, in the late 1960s by a fellow named Gabriel Veneziano, who is a great physicist at CERN in Geneva, and he was studying a different problem. He was studying protons and neutrons inside the nucleus of atoms, the so-called strong nuclear force, and he came upon an equation that seemed to describe the data pretty well. He didn't actually know what the equation was, but it seemed to work. A few years later, a fellow named Leonard Susskind at Stanford and some others as well, Holger Nielsen and Nambu and so forth, recognized that Veneziano's formula was describing strings. And that was really the birth of string theory. This is the early 1970s. It turned out, though, that there was still a way to go, because that formulation of string theory was not trying to be the theory of everything. It was not trying to be the unified theory. It was just trying to describe protons and neutrons. And in that particular purpose, it turned out that it failed. It didn't describe the data that was newly acquired in the mid-70s. But then a fellow named John Schwartz and a fellow named Michael Green came on the scene. And number one, Schwartz showed that this theory could describe gravity. And then he and Green in the 80s showed that certain problems that string theory had could be resolved. And then by 1984, that's when the physics community jumped on this theory. And that's when I was a graduate student. That's when I started to work on it as well.
Where's your doctorate from?
From Oxford.
From Oxford.
Yep.
And was that then a great establishment for this sort of thing?
Not really. In fact, there wasn't a great establishment for string theory because nobody in the world was working on it besides this guy Schwartz and Green.
I remember reading that one of your classmates at Oxford was George Stephanopoulos.
That's right.
He was not working on string theory.
No, he didn't really get in much to string theory those days.
What was he doing?
He was doing actually a degree in theology. That's what George
Yes,
did.
His father's a Greek Orthodox priest, I remember.
That's right, exactly.
Yeah. Oh, What a falling off was there. We pause for some commercials and then directly back to your calls and to your email. For calls, 591-7200. For email, extension 720 at tribune.com. And directly back to the phones for your calls to Brian Greene, who is the author of a book that is probably already on the New York Times bestseller list.
Yes, it is, yes.
Where was it on Sunday?
Well, it will be number three this coming Sunday.
And that book is titled The Fabric of the Cosmos, Space, Time, and the Texture of Reality. 591-7200, you are on the air. Good evening.
Yes, good evening. Would it be possible, my question is, would it be possible if you had a telescope powerful enough to actually see the Big Bang itself or one day after?
Yes, in principle, if you can see light that was emitted, you know, some 13.7 billion years ago, if you can see that far out into space, then you are looking that far back in time, yes. Now, there is a big obstacle, which is that light would have to penetrate a fuzzy haze that was produced about 400,000 years after the bang. It's called the microwave background radiation. So ordinary light can't penetrate that, but it could be that gravity waves can penetrate that. So a new kind of telescope is being developed that can detect gravity waves. There are actually two of these in our country alone. And in principle, those gravity wave detectors might be able to see all the way back to the Big Bang itself.
Is Arno Penzias still around?
Yes. Yep.
He's the man who discovered background radiation.
Yep.
And we might get some help from him on this.
Oh, you never know. We'll take help from any source.
He got a Nobel Prize for it.
Yes, absolutely. Yep. Penzias and Wilson.
Yeah. 591-7200, and here is the next caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Dr. Greene.
Hi.
You had talked about how speed affects time, but how about how gravity affects time?
Yes, I didn't get into that just for simplification, but you're right. Gravity also does affect the passage of time. So, for instance, if you go way up in a tall building, I don't know what the tall building is, a Sears building, is that still the tall building? So you go way up the building, then the gravity you feel is a little bit less than the gravity people feel on the ground. And that means that actually time elapses for you at a different rate than for those on the ground. It goes a little bit faster for you than for those on the ground because gravity, the stronger it is, the slower time elapses. Now, again, it won't be much for the Sears building, but were you to go to the edge of a black hole where gravity is very strong, time for you would slow down dramatically compared to the rate at which it would elapse for people not near the black hole. So if you went to the edge of a black hole, hung out for a while and came back, you, again, maybe a year older. Well, people on Earth may be 10,000 years older, depending on how close you got to the edge of the hole and how long you hung out there.
Well, could you get to the edge of the hole and not be
Well, it's a little dangerous. You don't want to do this without adequate rocket propulsion to stay outside the hole itself, because as we know, if you cross the edge of the black hole, the so-called event horizon, there's no turning back. You can't get out.
So It sucks you in,
so you don't want that to happen.
But, of course, at the other end, you come out in a different universe.
Oh, we don't know. That's a possibility. I mean, you say that jokingly, but people have suggested
that
if you go into a black hole, in fact, you can come out the other side. We don't know if that's true, but it's possible.
Well, because at the event horizon, I've heard that time actually stops.
Yes. Well, that's a very tricky idea. So time, we think, perhaps really stops at the center of a black hole. That's where there's a singularity that we don't understand well, and the hope is that string theory one day will allow us to understand it. But something at the edge, the horizon of a black hole, does happen, which is this. If you're watching somebody fall into a black hole, as they approach the event horizon, they will start to move slower and slower. They will look redder and redder. In fact, you will watch them take an infinite amount of time to get to the edge of the hole itself. So from that point of view, time sort of stops. From their point of view, though, they just cross right through the event horizon and plunge inward toward the center. This is one of the weirdnesses of the relativity of time. Time as you watch it will be very different from time as they experience it.
So I've heard theories that perhaps into the black hole you could go back in time.
I don't know really what that would mean. What I would say, though, is that when you cross the edge of a black hole, the roles of space and time interchange. So if you ask yourself, why is it that you get sucked to the center of a black hole and you can't get out? One answer is you get sucked to the center of a black hole in much the same way that you relentlessly move to the next second and the next second in time. Because the motion to the center of the black hole is really motion in time, not in space, because space and time interchange.
Sir, we thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Glad to have heard from you and on to another. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good morning, Doctor. Do neutrinos kind of fit the string theory, since they pass through everything and they might change?
Well, neutrinos absolutely fit into string theory. We describe them in much the same way as we describe every other particle. That's what we mean by a unified theory. It's a uniform language. So I mentioned how an electron would be a string vibrating in one pattern. A neutrino would simply be a string vibrating in a different pattern. Everything arises in exactly the same way.
And just one more other question.
Sure.
How does dark matter fit in this equation? I've heard that they're trying to explain space through dark matter.
Yes.
And then I've heard also it's trying to explain things like a black hole.
Well, one of the big open questions is, what is the dark matter made of? We have known for many years that there is more stuff in space than we can see, because most of the stuff in space doesn't give off light. That's what we mean by dark matter. We've been trying to figure out what constitutes the dark matter. What's it made of? One of the possibilities are so-called supersymmetric particles, which naturally do fit within superstring theory, or string theory as we call it for short. So it's possible that some of the vibrations of strings produce the particles that make up the dark matter. We don't know for certain, but that's something that people are studying intently.
Sir, we thank you for the call, and we'll take another. Good evening. You're on the air.
I guess that's me. Two questions. The first thing is, with the string theory, does absolute zero come into effect at all, where that cessation of all movement or molecular movement?
Well, good. First of all, let me just address that quickly. So
sure.
The notion of absolute zero being a place where all motion stops is actually a bit of a misnomer. Absolute zero would be the lowest temperature.
Okay.
But again, according to quantum theory, if you have a particle or a string, regardless of the picture that you use, you can't have it not moving and being at a definite location, because you can't say where something is and how fast it's moving with complete precision. It can't be done. So even at absolute zero, there's still a residual amount of quantum jitter, quantum motion.
I see. Okay, my second question is, and this has been driving us, we've been all doing this together. If at the creation of the universe, where there was the Big Bang, and we were all sort of created all at one time, why, if we're expanding away from each other during this, and we are looking at, if it was almost all instantaneously created at once, why are we looking back in time? We're missing that. And that's my last question.
I'm having a little bit of trouble understanding exactly what you mean, but let me just say a few words that perhaps will help.
Okay.
When the universe expands in the early part of the history of the universe, it actually expands faster than the speed of light. This is something which some people don't recognize. They think that nothing goes faster than the speed of light. That's a statement which really applies to motion through space. When the universe expands, it expands faster than the speed of light, which means that objects can be brought very, very far apart. They can outrun the light, and then they can look back to see the light traveling towards them. So I don't know if this helps you have an intuitive picture in your mind, but that's an important part of the
story.
Well,
I was just referring to the Hubble. It just had gotten to about the last 500,000 years or so.
Yes.
And we're looking at that, and that was the beginning of the universe, but yet where were we in relationship if we were all created at the same time? And I think you've answered that.
Okay.
And by the way, I've read your book, and I know what the reverse of time is, because I have to almost read it backwards. My mind's so slow, I can't comprehend everything. But thank you, great show, Milt.
Thank you, sir, for the call. And here is the next. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, Dr. Green. I read your book, Elegant Universe, twice, and I'm on your current book right now. And I just passed the one point where you're going through the explanation of the double slit experiment and how which way a photon, the path it will take, and,
yes,
and also about how the future can be affected by the past. Could you explain a little bit more?
Well, did you mean that the past affected by the future? Is that right. Well, there's an interesting set of experiments in quantum mechanics which don't actually show that the past is affected by the future, as you'll find when you finish that chapter, but do show an interesting interrelationship between past and future that really runs counter to our intuition. These are the so-called delayed choice experiments developed by John Wheeler, who's one of the great physicists, who is still alive, elderly gentleman, who coined the term black holes and many other important discoveries. And when you go through the details of those experiments, which I won't do on the air, you do find that there's a really interesting interplay between events that happen in the future and those that happen in the past, almost as though a measurement today helps complete a process that happened many, many years ago, and the process can't be completed until the measurement is undertaken. Very interesting set of experiments.
That all relates, doesn't it, to the insight developed so many years ago by Percy Bridgman and others, that the observation of an event alters the event.
Yes, absolutely. So part of quantum theory is that it's very difficult to think about a system isolated from its environment. We use that simplification in the early days of quantum theory to help develop the ideas. But there's really no such thing as an isolated system. Everything interacts with the environment, and the environmental interaction affects the thing that you're studying.
All is part of the main,
yes,
as John Donne said.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Or everything is eternally interconnected.
Well, everything is eternally interconnected. The interconnections can grow very, very weak and subtle.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not as though you have this gushy idea that we were sort of all created in the Big Bang and we're all sort of interconnected in that way. No. But there are some subtle interconnections that are very perplexing, but yet established well by the laws of quantum physics.
By the way, this isn't required as an assignment in your book, but you do touch upon it, I think. What can one, does the kind of theory you've been working with and the kind of analysis you've been doing have any bearing on the questions of the ultimate fate of the universe?
It does. So one of the most exciting discoveries of the last 5 years has been a discovery of the accelerated expansion of the cosmos. So since 1929, we have known through observations that the universe is expanding. But everybody thought that the universe is expanding, but it would be slowing down in its expansion because gravity pulls things back together. Like when you throw a ball in the air, it goes up, but it goes up slower and slower and slower. We thought the universe would be expanding slower and slower and slower. But indeed, the observations now show that it's expanding faster and faster, as if you threw the ball in the air and it went up ever more quickly. What this means is this outward push, this outward accelerated expansion, that the universe in the far future will continue to expand. It'll get larger and larger. It'll get less and less dense. It'll get cooler and cooler, and it'll just slowly peter out. That's the picture that these observations lead to.
The death, then, not merely of our solar system or of our galaxy, but the death of the universe.
Well, it's hard to imagine how things as we currently think of them could persist in a world, in a universe that would get very, 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 very spread out, very, very cool, very, very diluted. That seems to be the ultimate fate of the cosmos.
How many billion
don't worry about
years
it.
Is that away?
It's pretty far down the road.
Could be a billion.
Oh, no, it could be 100 billion or longer, but
yeah.
It's not something that will affect our daily lives, but it does sort of paint a picture of what the far future will be like. You know, there was a long time when people thought maybe the universe will expand for a while and then start to contract and sort of crunch in on itself.
The accordion model.
The accordion model, or the big crunch, as people called it. It now seems that the big crunch is likely not to happen because the expansion is speeding up. It's not slowing down.
Everything's getting away from everything else.
Yes, yeah. Completely.
591-7200 is the number. If you've been trying to reach us, try again. We've now got one or two lines actually available. Let me read a quick email for you. At last, God enters the question space. If the multiverse theory is valid and everything exists, would that include the supernatural?
I don't think so. I don't see any evidence in anything we do for what people conventionally call the supernatural.
Everything you're talking about is the natural.
The natural. We're talking about the natural. So, you know, I think that we don't need to invoke ideas that go beyond the physical, ideas that go beyond the physical laws. I've never seen any evidence for anything that required thinking that goes beyond that. There are people who disagree with me, but I've never been shown any evidence.
Well, there are some physicists who disagree with you, or at least an astrophysicist and cosmologist who have posited God as the ultimate source of the Big Bang or of the multiverse or what have you.
Well, that's pretty cool. You can't rule out God, right? And nothing that we do could ever give any evidence against God in the following sense. You could always say, the laws that you're finding and the data that you are finding, God set it up that way for you to find those things, and how could you ever prove otherwise?
In Dawkins' phrase, the blind watchmaker.
Yeah, right, exactly. So, you know, my own feeling is that if what we're doing is what these gentlemen say, and that we are revealing God's handiwork, God's laws, I'm happy to be part of a journey to reveal God's work. If what we're doing is just revealing the laws of physics and that's all there is, I'm happy to work on that. As far as my day-to-day life goes, I still will do the research that I do, regardless of which of those two frameworks it fits into. So I'm sort of happy with either.
I don't mean to get sidetracked into the usual question that this can often lead to about first cause and prime mover and so on, and thus God and all of that speculation. But if you speak about discovering the laws of the universe, one really is inevitably going to raise the question, who is the law? From where do the laws come? Is there a lawmaker?
Well, there could
be. A lawgiver.
Right, that's what I'm saying. There could be a lawgiver. There could be a God that gave us the laws. That's a possibility which I accept as a possibility. I don't find it to be a very interesting possibility. I find it more interesting to perhaps seek out laws that bring themselves into existence by pure logic. Perhaps the laws are so tightly construed, so tightly constructed, that they have to exist because it would be illogical for them not to exist. To me, that would be very satisfying. The answer would be they exist and they are the way they are because they couldn't be any other way. Any other way would be illogical.
But then you come to the great simple formulation. Nietzsche did it well. Others have done it. The basic question of why is there anything rather than nothing?
Right. Why is there something rather than nothing? This is a great question that Leibniz raised. And one potential answer, not that we've gotten there, but one potential answer is there could not be nothing.
Why not?
Because it would have violated the laws of logic itself. It would have been a tantamount to saying A and not A both being true. If we could find that the laws require there to be something, because were there nothing, it would be illogical, that to me would be a very satisfying conclusion. We're not there. We're not anywhere near there. But I can imagine that is a possibility which would completely obviate the need to invoke God.
I have a feeling you're dazzling me with some very fancy wordplay.
I hope not. I'm not trying to. That's the last thing in the world I ever want to do because I hate wordplay. I'm really trying to imagine that it could be that things are the way they are because were they different, were there nothing, it wouldn't make any sense. Not that it would be another possibility on equal
footing
with this.
Why does it have to make sense?
Good. So you could take one step further back. No matter what I say.
What requires sense?
Yeah. Regardless of what answer one gives to these questions, you can always say, why that?
Yeah.
So it's an endless regress from that point of view. I'm willing to say logic. I'm willing to sort of put forth logic as so basic that it's part of the very fabric of what there is.
That is a very Platonic answer.
It could be.
Know.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And you could question it, and people can question it. And I think the questioning is healthy. But I'm saying what I would find satisfying, I would be willing to stop. I'd be willing to stop the questioning if we could come to an answer that logic itself dictates the universe. Other people, perhaps you, wouldn't want to stop and would want to continue asking the question. And I say, go to it. That's
but
fine.
You're right. You're still caught in an infinite regress.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. But no matter what one says, you can always say why that.
Well, we have to stop for some commercials. You want to ask why?
Not really. I know why.
Why not? And back to Brian Greene. Here's an interesting question by email. Would a complete theory of everything provide an explanation for the emergence of life and consciousness, that is, as physical properties that spring out of simple particles, strings, etc.?
I think that in principle it would, but that answer is meaningless because in practice I don't think that it actually would. You see, the ingredients that we're talking about, as we mentioned, are fractions of an atomic size. And bridging the gap even from molecules to cells to consciousness is a gap that we have not been able to bridge.
And the great unanswered question that agitates all sorts of people, all the way from philosophers to neuroscientists, is the emergence of consciousness, of qualia, as they call it.
Yeah, I mean, to my mind, the three big questions are, how did the universe begin, how did life begin, and how did consciousness begin?
Mm-hmm.
And I and many physicists work on the first of those questions because in many ways it's the easiest. Because the universe, in many ways, is the simplest of those systems. Life is messy. It's got a lot of details. A lot of ingredients have to work together to produce life. Whereas the universe, it may have just been a few fundamental laws, and that's all you need to understand.
Another email picking up on what we were talking about just before we stopped for commercials. If logic is behind the existence of the universe, what about the randomness of events?
Well, we have to say what you mean by the randomness of events, and I guess since it's an email, we won't get clarification. But when we talk about quantum mechanics, which is the theory that has a random quality to it, it's very important to bear in mind that quantum mechanics predicts with complete certainty the probabilistic outcomes of any given experiment. So although there's a degree of randomness as to which outcome actually happens, the probabilities are predicted with complete precision. So quantum theory is anything but a random theory. It's very, very precise.
Back to the phones, 591 7200. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi. I had a question relating to, basically, you may have broached the subject earlier, whereas if the Big Bang happened at one point and all matter emitted from that point, how are we able to see back to the Big Bang? And granted, I work at the Board of Trade, and we just had a discussion about this because we have a lot of time to debate down there.
On the floor, is that what you mean?
Pretty much. But it relates to how we're able to see back to the original event. And what we came up with was basically a conundrum. And I appreciate, you know, being a layman, having the ability to ask this question, is that if at the instance of the Big Bang, light and matter were emitted from the same point, how are we able to see back to that point? And what we came up with was that either the matter had to be emitted at greater than the speed of light for us to be able to see back to that point, and then slowed down at some point so that we could actually see that.
Yeah.
I mean, does that...
It's definitely part of the story. So as we were saying before, although light sets a limit for speed through space, it doesn't set a limit on how fast space can expand. So space, in fact, does expand at greater than light speed in the beginning, which can drag objects. It weren't really objects then. It was just the gas that made up the earliest moments of the universe, stretch that material out to distances much greater than that which light could have traversed. And then you can look back and see the light that was emitted and, in essence, look back in time.
But if for us to see the actual event, would we not have to, as matter, have to have slowed down from the speed of light for the actual light from the event itself?
Oh, good, good. Right, so you're worried that we would permanently outrun it and we would never see it.
Exactly.
Well, good. So, indeed, we believe that the universe expanded at a superluminal rate for just a mere fraction of a moment early on. That allowed the universe, say, in inflationary cosmology that we discussed earlier, to grow by a huge factor. And then that huge inflationary expansion comes to an end. And the universe continues to expand, but expands at a slower rate, at a rate that's slower than the speed of light.
Oh, okay. And there was another thing that that one guy I was speaking with brought up when we were talking about this, is, and I may be a little unclear at this, but Einstein may have brought up the analogy that if two trains are traveling at the speed of light, next to each other through the universe, and one is slightly ahead of the other, that the one in the behind, that basically, if you know, if I'm traveling at the speed of light and you're traveling at the speed of light, and I look at you, you're traveling at the speed of light from me, making you travel at the speed of light squared, I guess. Is that just an invalid theory?
Well, I think you probably meant two times the speed of light as opposed to speed of light squared.
Sorry.
It's okay. I get the basic idea. But I think the thing that you really need to bear in mind is, number one, no material object can actually go at the speed of light. You can go near the speed of light. You can't go at the speed of light. But if you were running or you're on their train going near the speed of light and then you have your flashlight and you shine your flashlight, the light will run away from you, not at near twice the speed of light. It will go at the speed of light as well. So regardless of your own motion, light will rush away from you always at the fixed speed of the speed of light. That is relativity.
Oh, so relative to me, the light will be moving at the speed of light.
Exactly.
Away from me.
Okay. Exactly.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Glad to have heard from you. I'm amused by this. Comes an email, and the reference is to an extremely short story written by Isaac Asimov about a person he calls Isaac Intrepid. One day, Isaac was despondent and wanted to commit suicide. He goes back in time 10 months before he was born and kills his father. He doesn't vanish or anything, so he sits down very confused. Suddenly he bursts out in tears and cries out, "Oh, mother, how could you?" Thus causality can be preserved with time travel.
I must be very thick. I missed the last bit. What does he mean, "Oh, mother, how could you"? Can you just explain that?
He discovers that his father wasn't his biological father.
Oh, I understand. But there's another, let me give another resolution. It's a little less clever than that one. That's too clever by half. But in the multiverse picture, there's another explanation. Maybe Isaac travels to the past. Maybe he does kill his father before he was born. But maybe he kills his father in a parallel copy, a different universe than the one that he began in. Now the fact that he still is in existence, hasn't disappeared, is not puzzling. His father is the father that still lives in the first universe. The father that he killed was the copy of his father in this second parallel copy.
And so the second Isaac won't get born.
The second Isaac won't get born, but the first one is still there. I hope that redeems my inability to understand that story.
I'm sure it does.
I'm feeling kind of stupid now.
591-7200. Whatever you are, I don't think stupid is an applicable characterizer. And here is the next. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Oh, hello. Milt.
Yes.
Doctors, both an honor and a privilege this evening. I'm referring to an article that I read in Discover some months back. It posited a theory of the universe where there were as many as 7 membranes or planes of existence that were oscillating back and forth over an unknown time, over an unknown space, and that the Big Bang was created by the collision or the near being of 2 of these brains, as they referred to them as, and that the dark matter.
Yeah. There's a lot about brains in the new book by Brian.
Yes. So among the new developments in string theory the last few years has been the recognition that strings are not the only ingredient in the theory. There are extended objects of 2 dimensions that kind of look like, if you will, big, huge flying carpets, or 3-dimensional versions of those that get ever more difficult to picture in your mind. But one suggestion is that everything that we've thought of as being the universe just takes place on one of these membranes, one of these brains for short. The analogy I like to use is, imagine the entire universe is a big loaf of bread, and that everything that we know about is simply one slice of bread in a big cosmic loaf. And there could be other slices in this big loaf. And the theory that you're addressing suggests that maybe what happens is these slices of bread, these membranes, slam into each other. And it's the collision between the brains, between the membranes, that we think of as the Big Bang. It's called, in colloquial language, the Big Splat instead of the Big Bang, because these 2 things coming together. It's a theory that hasn't really caught on. It's been proposed by Paul Steinhardt at Princeton and Neil Turok in Cambridge. And it's worthy of study, and people are studying it, but many of us think that there's still many problems with the theory, especially truly understanding what happens when these brains collide.
A naive question. It's worthy of study, you say. How do you study?
Mathematically.
But what does that mean?
Well, you write down equations that govern physics on one of these membranes, and you try to study how physics would change if another one of these membranes slammed into it. You try to write down mathematics that would tell you what life would be like, in essence, were you living on one of these membranes when this collision happened. And you hope that the math will make sense, that it will make reasonable predictions. Right now, there's a controversy over whether the math does make sense. The proponents of the theory claim that it does. Other people have studied it and claim that it doesn't.
I'm sorry to be so reductionist, but what does it mean when an equation to make sense?
Well, you
since you're not
yes.
checking it against any
yes.
observable
no, it's a very good
extra
question.
Input of data.
Yeah. What we really mean is that the equation doesn't yield numbers like infinity as the answer to its solution. Again, infinity is the telltale sign that your equation makes no sense. It's a telltale sign that you're doing something
so
wrong.
So otherwise what you've established, if you don't hit infinity, is plausibility, not final verification.
I agree with you completely. But just to go back to the notion of infinity, you know, if you take a calculator and you put in 3 divided by 0, the calculator says error. It says an E on it, because that just doesn't make sense, because that's infinite. Similarly, our equations can yield error, infinite, doesn't make sense. If that happens, the equation doesn't work, and we don't believe that theory.
So what you're left with, at best, failing other kinds of data, is the judgment could be.
Good, but you say failing other data. So the proponents of this theory claim that it may give rise to observable signatures if the theory is correct.
Yeah.
The signatures would have to do with gravitational waves, things that we may be able to see one day or won't see one day. So it's not that the theory is permanently untestable. It's just perhaps untestable with today's technology.
Back to the phones, 591-7200. Good evening.
Hi, good evening. I've been listening to you guys talk about time and how it slows up as it gets towards the black hole and everything. And I work with electrocharged magnets, and the magnet I work with is 37,000 times the Earth's gravitational pull. UIC put in a magnet that's 100,000 times the Earth's gravitational pull. How strong is the gravitational pull towards the black hole that it actually slows up? We've always been taught that you have the rubber band effect, that it actually will slingshot you forward and then backwards. Is that not true?
I'm not exactly sure what you mean by the slingshot backward and forward, but when we're talking about the gravitational pull of black holes, we are talking about really quite enormous gravitational pulls. I mean, the black holes that, for instance, would have a significant impact on the passage of time could have a mass that's perhaps a million or a few million times the mass of the sun. And these, again, are not hypothetical objects. We believe that such a huge black hole exists in the center of the Milky Way galaxy. So we are talking about pretty huge agglomerations.
Well, my thing is, you know, like if you use electrocharged magnets, if something ferrous gets by it, as it's sucked in, it actually picks up speed, and we get a slingshot effect where it will actually shoot towards the back, and then it comes back out towards the front. Does that happen with time?
I don't think so. So, for instance, if you were falling towards a black hole, as we mentioned before, once you cross the event horizon, once you cross the edge, there's no slingshotting out. You're on a one-way ticket towards the center of the black hole where you'll be crushed out of existence. And time for you will continually slow compared to time for somebody far away.
Okay. Well, thank you. And what's the name of your newest book?
The newest book, sir, is The Fabric of the Cosmos by our guest, Brian Greene. The Fabric of the Cosmos, just published by Alfred Knopf.
Thank you very much.
And we thank you for the call, and let us go quickly to another. Good evening, you're on the air.
Yes, Dr. Green?
Yes.
I'd like to ask you a question concerning the holographic principle.
Okay.
I was reading on it, and it explained how the entropy of black holes, how it's painted on a two-dimensional surface, could prove that the universe is actually two-dimensional and actually a hologram. Now, I was curious as to how, if you believe this, and how this would apply to superstring theory.
Well, in fact, this idea, this holographic idea, really fits very naturally within string theory. Let me just say a couple of words about it. So we all know that a traditional hologram is a little thin piece of plastic, which when you illuminate it the right way, produces what looks like a three-dimensional image. It turns out that within string theory, this is very speculative. It's stuff that's happening today, so I want to caution. This is really part of cutting-edge research. But within string theory, it seems that something similar may happen. It could be that the fundamental laws of physics don't really operate in the world around us. They actually operate on a distant bounding surface that bounds the universe. And it's those two-dimensional laws, if you will, which when projected yield the three-dimensional world that we are familiar with. In other words, we could be the holographic projections of laws that actually fundamentally exist on a thin two-dimensional bounding surface that perhaps, in a sense, is analogous to a hologram. That's where this holographic principle comes from. Is it true? I don't know. Is it something that naturally fits within string theory? Absolutely, and we're studying it intently.
Okay, thank you.
We thank you, sir. Give me a quick tour of the horizon in terms of who's doing what. We've talked about a great deal of contemporary work, but what else is going on in your field? What are you excited by? Not in terms of your own work, but what your colleagues are doing.
Well, I think the most exciting thing is applying string theory to cosmology. String theory is a theory that, as we have discussed, puts together general relativity and quantum mechanics, and it should allow us to use the equations to roll the cosmic film right back to time zero and figure out how it all began. So, again, I won't focus on my own work, but our institute is dedicated to putting string theory and cosmology together. We just had a workshop in Santa Barbara all fall dedicated to string theory and cosmology, and we see that around the country and around the world, the issue of applying string theory to how the universe began is becoming the prominent question. And I think it's very exciting that it has taken on that prominent role.
Are there already competing hypotheses, but all based in string theory?
There are a number of ways of approaching string cosmology. One is this big splat that we discussed a little while ago, which I personally don't place a lot of faith in, but some people do. Other approaches imagine a regime before the Big Bang. These are called pre-Big Bang cosmologies.
What does one mean by regime?
Well, one imagines that the Big Bang was not the origin of time. Remember, we discussed earlier how it could be the origin of time, like you can't go further north than the North Pole. Maybe you can't go further back in time than the Big Bang. Other people say no. The Big Bang was an event that occurred in a pre-existing universe.
Yeah, well, the multiverse model.
But even beyond the multiverse,
this
imagines in one bubble, not in the many bubbles in the multiverse, but maybe in a single bubble, the Big Bang was simply an event as opposed to the creation event. And that has a natural home in string theory, too.
So the bubble was already there.
The bubble was already there, in a sense. we are following other leads. We are trying to study the effect of strings on microwave background radiation that might be observable. So I think all of these are interesting directions, interesting leads, and I hope that within a decade, somebody could sit down and say, here is the cosmological picture emerging from string theory. That's our goal, to get to that point.
Let's go to another caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you tonight, Dr. Green? Actually, I had kind of two questions. The first one being, and the gentleman earlier kind of touched on it himself with the, when he was talking about the trains, was if I was in my car traveling at the speed of light and I put my headlights on, would they do anything?
Well, they would travel away from you at the speed of light. But look, let me just reemphasize. You can only go near the speed of light. So let's be really clear on this. Any material object can only go near the speed of light. You turn on your headlights, they will, number one, rush away from you at the speed of light. And if somebody on the ground is watching you, they will see the light speed away also at the speed of light. It won't speed away at the speed of light plus the speed of your car, which is what you would intuitively expect. No, according to relativity, you will see the light rush away at the speed of light, and they will see the light rush away at the speed of light.
Well, that's good to know. At least it'll work if I ever get to that speed.
Yes.
The other question I had for you actually was real quick, was as far as black holes are concerned, and they do, you say they pull actually everything toward the center of them. Is it theoretically possible for black holes to run into each other? And if so, what is your theory on what would happen?
Sure. Absolutely. Black holes can collide. And people have done calculations using general relativity to see what would happen. And part of what would happen is they would send off gravitational waves. They would disturb the fabric of the cosmos and send ripples heading outward, a tidal wave of ripples heading outward. And we, in fact, here on Earth, may be able to detect those ripples through these gravitational wave detectors that have been built and are now up and running. Our hope is to see black holes collide as one possibility through these detections.
Well, thank you very much.
We thank you, sir, for the call.
Thank you.
Well, it's been a very vigorous night on the telephone lines, and for that matter, with the email. I've got one email here. I turned on your program by chance tonight and was floored to find a terrific interview with the physicist and one that could translate science to lay people, and I became an instant fan of your show. Thanks for offsetting all of the ranting, simple-minded junk out there. I'm looking forward to your upcoming shows. So you're helping us build an audience.
Oh, great.
After 30 years doing this program, I find the man who can really help us build the audience. Come back again tomorrow night. Or if you can't do that, we will instead do what is scheduled tomorrow night, namely a basic news review. Our guests will be old friends, John Mearsheimer of the Political Science Department at the University of Chicago, Dick Ciccone, formerly the managing editor of the Chicago Tribune, Ian Hurd, also a political scientist from Northwestern University. Thursday, by the way, we're talking about dreams with a leading science journalist, Andrea Rock, who's been looking closely into dream research. She's the author of a new book titled The Mind at Night, The Science of How and Why We Dream. On Friday, we are fully preempted by a Cubs game beginning at 8:05. Monday night next week is the beginning of Passover, so I will not be here in person, but I will be here on tape. Some tapes that we've done recently that we think you'll find of interest. And on Tuesday next week, we talk with a number of people who were active in radio when radio was still very active in Chicago. I mean, those who worked as actors in the soaps in Chicago. And still other things coming that I don't have time to tell you about. I do want to simply and quickly once again mention that the title of the new book by Brian Greene is The Fabric of the Cosmos, published by Alfred A. Knopf. Brian, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And thanks to all for listening. We'll be with you again tomorrow. Until then, a cordial good night.